Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. My name is Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer behind Game Wisdom. Now, last week, for those of you who remember, we had Ernest Adams on, and we were promising a part two. But unfortunately, it turns out his schedule was far more busier than he originally anticipated, and we're going to have to push that back a bit. So, for a backup this week, my guest is returning from Quarter to 3.com, Jason McMaster.
Hey, everybody. How you doing?
Hey, Jason, it's great to have you on. I think this is the first time we've had you on this summer, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. It's been a pretty crazy summer.
Yeah, I know. Weather-wise, it's just been crazy here on the East Coast. We've had rain, the heat, and then like the weather just says like 5 days of rain, and then nothing happens. And then on the one day, it said it was going to be bright and sunny. We had thunderstorms.
Of course, yeah. It always works that way.
Yeah. So, for those of you listening to this, we are actually recording this late Friday night, because everyone is still pretty much in vacation mode, so we're going to keep the cast relatively light this week. For the news that I want to talk about is this interesting post that the Puppy Games lead designer made. Now, for those of you who don't know who Puppy Games are, they're the developers behind, I think it's Revenge of the Titans, a game called Ultratron, and let me pull up their site here. And they, well, while I'm pulling that up, they've been part of the industry now for, I think, like 5-6 years. Is that right? Yeah, they've been apart for a while. Revenge of the Titans, Drone Assault, Titan Attacks, and Ultratron. So they've been doing this now for several years. They, of course, were making games, I think, right around Steam started to really kick in. And I think probably a little bit before that as well. And what has gotten them in the news has been a post that they made basically on their blog, where they were pretty much condemning sales, talking about pretty much what they consider the dark side of indie PR. And I'm going to put a link to it in the notes below. But the gist of it is that they've been pretty much feeling the burn of the indie depreciation in game value. We've talked about this on multiple podcasts. There's been posts about this all over the internet. But essentially, as video games have been depreciating in value, it has sort of been affecting indie developers as well. Because while the AAA developers have been, you know, throwing money at advertising and millions into game development, there's still a lot of guys on the lower tier of indie development who are pretty much not getting the funding they need because they're selling their games for, you know, a dollar here, 5 cents, or whatever, due to sales, Humble Bundle, etc. So his post was pretty much a just condemning sales. And it was quite an interesting read, and it's something that we normally don't hear about, especially because the whole process of Steam and how developers interact with it is pretty much a guarded secret. I think just about everyone has to sign a non-disclosure agreement with Steam when they get onto it. So the part about that I want to discuss, at least briefly for tonight, is about the issue with sales and whether or not they're condemning the industry or are they saving it. So I guess the first question then for you, Jason, is what do you think about game sales? Since I know you've been part of the game industry probably around as long as I have. I think you've been following games since the 90s, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you remember, of course, the dark time when games were $80, $90 a pop. There was no such thing as game sales. Pretty much, we were strictly a retail-oriented industry. So, what do you think about this?
Well, it is somewhat of a problem, in a way, for the indies. I mean, there's no doubt, of course. Mm-hmm. If everybody just waits for the sale and everybody purchases their game on sale, they make literally not literally, but close to nothing. Mm-hmm. Compared to what they normally would. So that does hurt their value. However, you have to wonder exactly how much, like iSpace, there, you know, they would get otherwise without Steam and without the sales.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know. It comes down to what you want to do. Like it's really like in the mobile market when people were first making mobile games, you know, they would try to sell them for 99 cents, do whatever, or a few bucks, mm-hmm. and then everything's included. And then they realized that, you know, their sales would spike tremendously if they dropped the price of their game, mm-hmm. and even just gave it away to get up to the top of the, you know, sales charts so that people would notice it. Mm-hmm. And then they got wise and started, you know, releasing their games for free and just making everything purchasable within. Yeah. You know, and it sucks to, you know, but I'm sure you're going to see more of that coming because of stuff like this.
Yeah, it's definitely become a double-edged sword for a lot of developers. As you said a few minutes ago, when you're selling the game for, 5 cents, a dollar, whatever, yes, you're making tons and tons of sales, but then again, 1,000 sales at a dollar is still only $1,000. And another part that he complained about on the Puppy Games blog was regarding the people who buy the game for really cheap and then they expect, tech support. They want you to fix the bugs, fix all these problems when you only spent, 5 cents or whatever. And this is one of those things that, again, it's very murky area as someone who knows both game development and is also a consumer. Obviously, the consumer in me wants to say, yeah, you sold the game, you should fix it. But then the part of me that knows about game development says, if you don't have the budget to fix all these problems, what are you going to do?
And that's kind of one of the big problems with Kickstarter as well, but that's a different subject altogether. But yeah, no, support of the product is somewhat of a nightmare. I think that's why so many of the game engines are so popular, you know, like Unity and all that.
Man, because it cuts down on development and the database is there for people who need to support and fix it. And obviously, it cuts down on costs because you don't need to develop your own engine, which that's something that I have no idea how much that would cost.
That's a lot of time.
Now, with sales, the other part of this has to do with game pricing. And this is another real trouble area, especially for indie developers. As you mentioned a few seconds ago, Jason, regarding mobile developers and how they've raced from, 99 cents to now free with microtransactions, a lot of indie developers are feeling the burn in terms of trying to release a quality product. It seems like anyone who prices their game at $20 or more is going to get complaints from consumers saying, I don't want to spend that money. And we've seen this with developers like Uber with Planetary Annihilation, Introversion with Prison Architect, and even Gaslamp Games with their latest title, Clockwork Empires, that was just put on Steam under early access for $30. And with Clockwork and Gaslamp, what's interesting is that they've already came out and said that the game is going to stay at $30 between now and release, and that's going to be its actual price. So there's no, you can't buy it
Incentive.
early. Exactly. No incentives for buying it early. There's not going to be any crazy price changes. I know a lot of people were confused by Planetary Annihilation that was at it started at 80, then went to 60, 40, and I think right now it's either at 20 or $30 on Steam.
Strange.
It had to do with how they were tying buying the game at the various development tiers to the Kickstarter pledges. And but that's a whole nother can of worms to really get into.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So the problem though, and going back to what Puppy Games is saying, is that when they're basically forced to cut their price at the knee in order to get people to buy their title, they're not really getting anything back. They're not making the money back in terms of development costs. And this is just one of the things that it's really hard to pick a side of it, because as we said before, both Jason and I, we are from the age where there weren't any sales. So we know how crazy it was back then. So I guess the next question for you, Jason, is if in terms of living in an industry with or without sales, what would you pick?
Well, that is a good question because it's hard to say what it would be like without. Because PC gaming did have a big has had a big resurgence, but you know, I think a lot of that has to do too with how kind of easy it is to get a laptop that's decent and a computer that's decent nowadays, and how cheap that is. However, you know, Steam has been a big deal for PC gaming, like a really freaking big deal. So it's hard to say how it would look without sales, you know? I mean, like Origin maybe. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. I think the sales are needed. I just think that there's a lot of casualties that get caught in them.
And that's sort of what I wrote in a post this week about in terms of game industry myths, where I talked about sales. I think one side effect of sales is that it's really become an equalizer for a lot of game developers. and it's forcing a lot of people really to step up their game. You can't really make like the equivalent of a Flash title and sell it for $10, $20 these days.
Right.
Because we've got, you know, dozens if not hundreds of new developers popping up trying to release their games. So it's forcing people to make higher quality titles. But on the flip side of that, as we just said a few minutes ago, the industry is being devalued. So it's becoming harder to actually sell those higher quality titles.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is what we talk about with Prison Architect, Planetary Annihilation, and Clockwork. Well, what they're facing is that those three developers are all pricing their games pretty much at premium pricing for what any developer can charge. And it's just very, I think it causes a lot of people to feel weird when you're spending that amount of money on a game that's not being sold in a store. You're not going to see tons of advertising about it. And I think there is that different mindset between buying a game digital and buying a game physical. I think people expect more when you buy a physical copy, and they sort of are conditioned to spend more on that. So when you have, you know, a game that's purely digital go for $40, $50, I think it causes a few people to get confused.
Yeah, and, you know, another thing that's not really fair, too, about, I guess, about the Steam sales for the indie developers is, like, every game costs like nothing, you know? So like they're kind of competing with, you know, the big names really, really closely on price point. And people feel a lot better about spending $20 on like Call of Duty.
Yeah. But,
or Borderlands or something.
Yeah, but it's a different story when it's, you know, a game like something from Arkane Games or Gaslamp's Games, when you see like a $20 game, $25. And then what happens is, what if your game is like one of the few that's not part of a Steam sale? So then you've got, you know, the front page with everything at $4, $5, 75 cents. And then there's your game sitting there at $25. People are going to think, you know, you're being stingy with your game. Because I've, you know, seen that comment made enough times on forums as well, when people will say, oh, you know, how dare you charge $30 for this when I can buy whatever for 75 cents?
I mean, that's always going to be kind of like the argument people are going to use. It was, you know, it was hacking before that, or just like stealing games before that, you know. It was like, it's not worth it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it's one of those things that it's not going to go away, I think, no matter what games are going to be priced.
No.
Now, another part of sales, I think, that is not really brought up a lot is the fact that, and this is what I wrote about in my blog post, was that sales are meant to really bring in the non-fans, the people who weren't going to look at your game to begin with. And this, I think, is one of the better examples of why sales are great for the industry. Because, I mean, over the last, two, 3 years, I can't even count how many games I've actually bought that I wouldn't have bought, you know, at all if at their full price.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this was a time where I finally started playing some games from Paradox. I bought, of course, Goat Simulator for reasons.
Oh, sure.
But these were games that I wasn't even going to look at their original price. Or Gone Home, that's another great example. To me, Gone Home wasn't worth $24. But when I bought for, I think, $5 or $10 on one sale, that was the right price point. And that was a case where I wasn't going to look at that game otherwise. So it's getting people to experience a lot more games, which I think is great. We're seeing people spending more money, but they're not spending it on each individual title.
Right. You know, and another thing, like when it comes to Gone Home, that game has probably done pretty well for itself as well. It was critically acclaimed, I think, if I remember correctly. So they, you know, they had that fortune. I think really almost the kind of a bigger issue for almost some game companies would be the bundles.
You mean like the Humble Bundle, stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to actually bring that up next, too. For those of you who aren't aware, the Humble Bundle is an extension of the Humble Store. Actually, Humble Bundle came first. And what it is I think every week now, or every 2 weeks, they have a bunch of games put on there at pay what you want price. And you can donate a cent to $1,000. And there's different tiers based on how much you donate to. There's usually a beat the average tier, and then there's, you know, like the high end tier, which is maybe $7-$8. But they're selling games that it would normally cost you maybe $50-$60 for this pack, And you can basically buy it for $1. I mean, I just did that with the latest one. I forget the name of it. Someone with Galactic Civilizations 2, Van Helsing, and a few other games.
Oh, yeah, Humble Jumbo Bundle.
Yep. That's it, yeah. But yeah, that was the case where I got pretty much $60, $70 worth of games for $1. I mean, you really can't get better than that. But as you said, Jason, if you think about from a developer standpoint, they probably got hundreds of people buying the game, but they only spent maybe $1.50 to buy that game.
Yeah, and you have to think, too, they can, can't you choose your distribution?
Yeah, if you can decide when you're checking out, basically, who gets the cut of what you're donating. So you can donate more to the Humble Bundle itself, or the Humble Store, to the developers, or to whatever charities are being supported by the bundle at that time.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it's kind of, like, variable.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little strange.
Yeah. And the Humble Bundle is not the only place. We're seeing pretty much any online store these days running sales, promotions, just to get people to buy these games. Green Man Gaming just did a sale. GOG's been running yearly, seasonal, even weekly sales on their games. And when I spoke with one of the guys from GOG a few months ago, I asked them about the sales and has it had an effect on their profits, and they said yes, people have been buying more games because of the sale. But again, this sort of goes back to that murky area of developer versus store. I mean, obviously Steam is making, you know, money hand over fist at this point.
No one
is gonna cry for a game new world being poor anytime soon.
Jesus. No.
But on the flip side, the developers, the guys who are making the games and are trying to earn a living, they may be facing trouble, and obviously Puppy Games is one such example of that.
Right.
Yep. So what has really happened over the last few years is that it's become sort of this three-way pool between developer, consumer, and the stores. And as we've talked about, it's becoming harder and harder for developers to sell higher-priced games to consumers, and trying to essentially show that value has become the pressing challenge for the game industry over the last few years. And we're seeing developers from, you know, all ends of the scale trying to basically come up with a way. We've got mobile developers, as you said, Jason, who are pricing their games at free-to-play and then going the monetization and microtransactions model. We've got the AAA developers going, you know, they're trying to get pre-order bonuses and all kinds of crazy stuff. I know Sony just announced more plans behind their subscription service. Probably Microsoft has a plan there. EA, I think, didn't EA just announce they're doing some kind of like monthly service, like subscription service?
EA Access. I think they invited me to join it on Xbox One a bit ago, and I accepted. I just haven't really looked at it very much.
Yep. And, of course, we got pre-order bonuses. I know I just read the new Sid Meier's Civilization game. They're running pre-order exclusive maps. So everyone is trying to instill more value into their games. They're trying to get you to buy them earlier and at a higher price because, obviously, while stores like Steam, Green Man Gaming, and so on are going to make money, you know, regardless, the less you spend on a game means the less that goes into the developer's pocket. And as we said with like a lot of the indie developers, they're really starting to feel the burn there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think with that, we're going to basically end the discussion for now. I know for next week's cast, we'll probably talk about a bit more as we're going to have an actual indie developer on, one of our returning guests. I'll let the audience sort of think about that, you know, add some suspense to things. But let's move on to our next topic. As I said again, we're going to move pretty quickly as this is sort of our Plan B cast, so there wasn't really a strict schedule. So talking about games we've played, this week, probably strange as it sounds, I really haven't been playing a lot of video games, which is shocking as the guy who runs a game site and game podcast. The only game that I've really been playing on and off was DC Universe Online. There was a Steam sale on a bunch of the DLC, I think a week or so ago, and I decided to snatch up as much as I could, so I've been running a new character there and just playing through that again. I played it Wow, I think like the first month I went free to play, I think like a few years ago was when I first played DC Universe. So now I'm playing it again, and I hate to say, but not much has really changed. But then again, with a lot of MMOs, I don't think they do a lot of early game changes. I know WoW's whole model is adding, more and more raid content, bumping up the level cap at the end. Now,
Right.
Jason, did you play any of DC Universe Online?
Very limited amount. I think I played like an hour or two.
Did you play when it was free to play or when they had like the original subscription model?
Free to play on the PlayStation 3.
Yeah, I heard some interesting news that it's actually considering doing really well on the PlayStation 3. I think it's coming to PlayStation 4 or it's already on there. I'm not 100% sure. But it's still a very action-oriented MMO, which I liked. The last MMO that I really got into was Star Trek Online, which of course also went the free-to-play route, and that was when I got into that.
Yeah.
But other than that, this week has been relatively quiet. I mean, there's been a Doctor Who marathon, the Simpsons marathon's going on,
Oh yeah.
so I have to catch up on all 522 episodes of The Simpsons.
Yeah, there you go.
So it's not like there hasn't been anything to do. So, what about you, Jason? What games have you been playing?
Well, I got the Diablo 3 Ultimate Evil for the PlayStation 4. I've been playing that a good bit, and it looks awesome.
Now,
God.
with the Diablo 3, did you buy what's considered the expansion, or did they just, when you buy the Ultimate Edition, you get the original plus Reaper of Souls?
You get Reaper of Souls with
Okay.
Ultimate Evil, yeah. So, yeah, it comes with like adventure mode and all the updated difficulties and stuff like that.
Now, I heard people really complimenting the console version as opposed to the PC version. I think the one thing I heard a lot about was that the loot design was a bit different for the consoles.
Yeah, it's actually, I think they've updated the PC version to reflect that as well now, but yeah, when it came out on the 360 initially, it had the newer loot model before they released it and did anything on the PC. And I guess the biggest reason for that is because they had released the PC version and people were already invested in all of the what was going on there, and they needed to give it time before they changed their system ever. But the loot is now a lot more tailored to your character. It's a lot more bountiful. You don't like, I don't know. Did you play Diablo 3, Josh, much or at all?
I played it pretty heavily the month Reaper of Souls came out, and
Oh, okay.
then I sort of tailored off, and I'll probably talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but finish what you were talking about.
Yeah, so like when the game originally came out, I liked it, but the only way to really get good loot in it was to beat it multiple times and then build up Nephilim Valor stacks, and it was kind of lame. It just you had to, I don't know, it was God, it was like so grindy, and there was never any real good rewards you got. So I guess they looked at it and figured that the auction house is the reason. And really, the auction house is what kind of took the magic out of the original Diablo 3 release as well. I mean, the whole point of that game is to go through and find awesome loot, equip it, and kill stuff to get more awesome loot. It's not fun if the whole Tom's favorite word, fun, but like, it's not fun if the entire game is run around, find stuff, sell it on an auction house, take that money and buy stuff that actually you can use on an auction house. I mean, it's just not that much fun to it. There's no like excitement when, you get a drop. But they're doing to Diablo 3 what they did with Diablo 2, which is it's still just such a living, evolving game. Like the adventure mode, though I haven't had much time with it, is great. It randomizes everything, changes the dungeons up. That's just really awesome. And the console version, I think one of the reasons people like it is it's weird. They kind of embraced the whole console feel. Whereas in the PC version, you're clicking to the point of carpal tunnel syndrome. In that, You can tap the buttons, you can hold them down, but the big deal, the big change is that there's a dodge, a right stick. The right stick dodges, and that can destroy items and stuff like that, or crush stuff. So you can get like speed boosts from it and everything. And it's got a lot more of a gauntlety kind of control feel in a way, and that's cool. It works really well for this game. The only thing I think I could ever knock it for is possibly targeting. If you're trying to do specific things, like I can see that being an issue, but Diablo 3 is so based off of area of effect and all that that it hasn't really become a problem. So I must say I'm very impressed, and it really is attractive. It's like the PlayStation 4 version, like I'm playing, it looks like a, the top of the line PC running it, and it runs it really smooth. I mean, tons of debris, really nice looking. So I can't Oh, one cool thing about the console version too is that like monsters will appear in your game that come from other like your friends' games, and if you beat them, like you both get like a reward for it. Or I was playing the other day and picked up some loot, and I looked in my pack and it was like loot, but it was for someone on my friends list, so I just chose to mail it to him. So like random people can get loot and then like end up mailing it to you because it dropped in their game. It's like got all these weird like little social connective things, and they just I don't know. It works pretty well.
That's interesting. Now, regarding the dodge mechanic, I found that very interesting because the PC version, as you said, doesn't have that.
Oh
And
no.
I know Blizzard has basically stated explicitly that no matter what, Diablo 3 for the PC will never be able to be played with a gamepad. So that will
Right.
probably never be in there. Now, with Diablo 3, I think my big problem with it, and I think a lot of other expert or long-standing fans are having with the game, is that it does feel very, I think this, in a sense, it feels very sterilized. It feels like the whole experience is being crafted and, being controlled in a sense. Like, there's not that sense of variety. Now, with the adventure mode, that has sort of helped at least alleviate, the whole going through the campaign over and over again.
Right.
But it still feels like things are a bit too set in their ways, both in terms of loot design and with the skill gem system. In the sense that once you've got something that you like, it becomes very hard to try to do something else. And this also goes
True.
back to the fact that loot is still a very simple choice because it has to do with your primary attribute or the weapon damage if you're holding a weapon.
Right.
So you don't really get that huge variety of things that we saw in Diablo 2. But on the flip side, the moment-to-moment gameplay, I think with Diablo 3, is probably one of the best I've seen in the action RPG genre in a very long time.
Yeah, there's I mean, they really do kind of a good job on a lot of their randomization, and their just dungeon design, their dungeon crawls and stuff. So it does really have great just standard gameplay, just really smooth.
I guess what I'm really missing are more ways to really differentiate my character, more variety in loot. An example that I use in my review of Diablo 3 was the fact that no matter what weapon you equip, it has no bearing on your actual strategy during combat. All you really care about is whatever numbers are attached to that. So if you're wielding like a little dagger or a two-handed mace, no, it doesn't really matter compared to what those weapon stats are. Where
True.
the counterexample would be Path of Exile, where every weapon has its own unique perk based on that weapon class. So your dagger has extra critical hit chance, claws give you life on hit. And I think it's kind of funny that Path of Exile is sort of like the antithesis of Diablo 3,
Yeah.
where it has, like this extensive, long game of the massive skill tree running through all the chapters over and over again. But Diablo 3, as we said, the moment to moment, I think, is stronger there. Like when you're playing as a witch doctor and you're just letting loose like
Yeah.
a fetish army or
Oh, yeah.
Gargantuan, it's just awesome. Or I love the Crusader, the new class with like all like
Yeah, he's
this.
really cool. That's what I'm playing on the PS4. It's a I played Monk and Wizard mostly, but
And I just
yeah.
love the Crusader, just like running into a group with the shield bash and then just
Oh,
watching,
yeah.
shit just blow away, and then like his the ultimate spell when you turn like this massive like suit of this massive badass armored guy.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like looking at the art book that came with it, and I just love like the art design for the Crusader and just how they really got
Oh,
this
yeah.
big bulky character. And I think that's like sort of like where I'm of two minds about Diablo 3. I love a lot about it, but it's the parts that I don't like that just sort of upset my experience. But as you said a few minutes ago, Jason, it is an ever-evolving game, and
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure Blizzard's got some massive, insane patch ready. And I know patch, I think it was patch 1.2, that was sort of like the breaking point or the resurrection point for Diablo 3, because that's when they basically altered the loot. They
Yep.
basically said, at this point, don't even worry about the auction house. That 1 month before Reaper of Souls came out, that was basically when all my friends and I got back into Diablo 3 from that one patch.
Oh yeah, no, that was a genius patch. And that's what like the Diablo team is known for in a way, 'cause if you were you a Diablo 2
Oh,
fan?
yeah.
Okay, just wondering. Yeah, we were of course too. Like the 1.10 patch for Diablo 2, where it made like like random bosses spawn and stuff like that. That was such a huge thing. And it's like they've always had these like crazy patches. They've been patching, freaking Diablo 2 is an old game at this point, and they still patch the damn thing on occasion. So it's insane. They're very good about long term support. They're like the opposite of EA when it comes to like long term support.
Yep, and that's the thing with Diablo 3. I haven't played the game in probably 3, 4 months, maybe a little less than that, but it's still on my hard drive, and I'll probably return to it whenever the next patch is. Because, as you
Oh,
said,
yeah.
they will keep changing it. And it's going to be interesting just to see how it's going to be. I mean, again, Diablo 3 from retail to patch 1.2, it's night and day with all the
It
changes they've
is.
made.
And like I loved Diablo 3 when it came out. And I think that a lot of people had a hard time with it at first because of really stupid UI decisions and options like the elective mode. I mean, nobody really knew what that was or explored it at first, and it kind of gave a lot of people a bad impression that you had to choose between certain buttons for certain places, whereas in elective mode, you can put them wherever you want.
And I know for me, the second I found that, that was
Oh, me
turned
too.
on, that would never be turned off in my game. So,
Yeah.
and so it was like the ability to hold down button and have him auto run without having to target characters,
Oh,
because
yes.
that saves your life when you're fighting some of the bosses.
Oh, yeah. That's a cloud. Always buying that to Z just so I don't freaking. Oh, yeah, you gotta do.
And I guess as a quick, just random tangent in terms of another game that I love, but like the parts that I don't like sort of soured, would probably be XCOM Enemy Unknown. Did you play that?
Oh I haven't played Enemy Within, though I have it. I haven't actually played it.
I mean, that's a game that it's one of those games that it's so close to hitting all the right buttons for
Yeah.
me, but just how much they've sort of sterilized a lot of the complexity, a lot of the randomness from the original game is what sort of keeps me from absolutely falling in love with that game. It's again, it's another one of those games that I like to come back to once every few months, but unlike Diablo 3 and Blizzard, I don't think Firaxis is supporting it as heavily. I think the last patch came out really when Enemy Within came out, and there hasn't
Yep.
been anything new since, which is a shame because I would love for them to sort of explore that in the same scale as Blizzard with Diablo.
I do like that they added all those variables, if you know what I mean, like where you can change difficulties and like add all the different like hard or easy or whatever,
Or
little
you mean like
switches.
the second wave options for XCOM?
Right, yeah.
Those are really great, and they
Yeah.
really do change the game. It definitely brings it closer back, or brings it more back to the original. What I've
Right.
done is when I play it, I put on like random soldier attributes, random
Yeah.
soldier skills. I mean, it
That's
makes the
awesome.
game freaking hard. I mean, I still haven't beaten
Yes.
the game yet, but
Oh,
it makes it so that I want to keep playing it, unlike if it was so rigid that the same things or the same events would happen every time.
Yeah, no, that's like, the original XCOM and freaking God, Terror from the Deep. Holy God, that was the hardest damn game. But yeah, all those games, man. XCOM has a special place in my heart. But yeah, Enemy Unknown, I don't know. There are times when I get either frustrated or bored with it pretty quickly for some reason.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I like I said, I still haven't beaten Enemy Within yet because I just find that the parts that I don't like just rub me the wrong way so much that I just can't get past them. But it's so close to being one of my perfect games.
Well, with Enemy Within, isn't it the same story?
It's essentially what they've done is they just added supplemental content to the game. So
Oh,
it's
okay.
not like a new campaign. It's basically there's a new enemy that will show up. You have new research options available,
Oh, okay.
but it's not like there's like a new ending or a new chapter after the original game.
Yeah, I should load that up and play it when next time I get a chance. Next time I it runs really well on my Mac laptop, so that's what I should do when I get a chance. Go if I have to go anywhere.
Are there any other games you play this week that you want to bring up?
Jeez, I've played League of Legends as always, but Risen 3 just came out. I've been playing it some. I really like it, but there's this giant caveat of I also really like Gothic 2 and Gothic 3, and so make of that what you will. And if people don't know what I'm talking about, the Piranha Bytes Gothic series has been a not Piranha Bytes, they're the publisher. It doesn't matter. Anyway, the Gothic series has been people don't look on the controls very favorably when it comes to combat. It's kind of weird. However, since they switched over to Risen, the team that made the first three Gothics, they've been improving their combat controls, and this one's better. But the game is still really difficult. But for those that don't know, Risen is a role-playing game. And in this iteration, you're a pirate for some reason, though that doesn't really, you don't do that many piratey things per se, so I don't know how that really comes into it that much at the moment. But it's a role-playing game, and you have access to a relatively large world that you can go just about anywhere in. It's very handcrafted and tailored feeling. Whereas, Skyrim's awesome because it's just like this massive freaking map that you can just, wander forever and go in a direction and just, kind of get immersed. Whereas, Risen and the Gothic games before it, they're smaller in scale, but they feel like every inch of the map was meant for you to explore it. It just kind of it's very personal feeling. In fact, up until I would say The Witcher 2, I think Gothic 2 is probably one of my favorite RPGs, if not my favorite. But Risen 3 is really interesting. There's all these little islands, and they're adding islands as DLC. And well, I say little islands, they're actually quite sizable. You explore through it, and you make choices, and depending on your choices, you can join different guilds and stuff, and that'll change how the game runs. But it's a real hoot, and if anybody actually wants to see it, I've been streaming it on twitch.tv/JV McMaster, and there's old videos on there too if you want to go through them. And I've played about 8 or 9 hours of it, I think, so far. But it's been a really good time. I always enjoy those games, though they are brutally difficult in the beginning, at least specifically in the beginning. But they are, they're pretty hardcore RPGs.
And I think I've talked about this on previous casts. I've never been a huge, I think, PC RPG fan. I didn't get into Fallout, Skyrim. I just don't. Yeah, I know. I'm just not into like those like huge massive worlds. I think I like the RPGs where there's a lot more, I guess, depth, but a lot more singular focus. Stuff like Demon Souls, Dark
Oh,
Souls,
sure.
and stuff like that. I guess with the series, now Horizon 3, do they do anything like this heavy mod or expansion support like Bethesda does with Skyrim?
No. What classically what the games like Gothic and the earlier Risen's have done is they've been like community patched and community built, but not in the same way. They're like big community projects to like make sure the bugs get fixed, but not really a patching or a add-on kind of game, no.
All right, so I guess with that said, I just want to talk briefly about the subject of basically some unusual game promotions that we've been seeing over the last few months. And essentially, it's developers' ways of drumming up more interest for their respective titles. So the one that I've been paying attention to since I'm a fan of the game would be Payday 2 from Overkill Software. And what they've been doing is basically promoting heavily the idea of Crime Fest, which is they're basically dedicating the day October 18th, which I'm not sure why October 18th is a big deal. I know it should be. I think it has something to do with when they first started working on it. I know the game was released August. It was the big 3-year anniversary, I think, a few weeks ago. What Crime Fest is essentially they're trying to drum up more people to join the Payday 2 Steam community group. So according to this check that's happening right now, they're at just over 1,274,000 people in the group. So what they've been doing is for every 50,000 members or 50,000 more people who join the group, they're going to add some free content for anyone who is a member of the group. They've already given some stuff out, including like brass knuckles you can equip, a unique mask, a golden AK-47. What's been interesting is that the ones that they've been running for this promotion have been actual DLC. So for right now, people are going to get one of the new heists where they break out one of the old characters from the first Payday for free. So that was originally going to be something that would probably cost, I think, $5, $6, maybe a little bit more. So that's going to be interesting. And then they're teasing stuff later on. So when they get 1.4 million members, they're going to lock a new enemy class. 1.45, they're going to add day-night cycles to certain maps. And then, of course, right now their highest goal is 1.5 million members, and that they're not telling you what they're going to give. It's all secretive. And it's kind of an interesting promotional idea. And this is sort of another thing that has sort of been given birth thanks to digital distribution and the ease of which developers can interact and change things with their games. Now, I know, Jason, you have an example too that just happened with Dota 2.
Yeah, they released what the Compendium, which was this kind of a virtual book that you would have in the game, and for however many people purchased it, the prize pool for their international tournament would go up, and you would get certain certain bonuses for however many people purchased it, like different voices and customizations, and for using the compendium you got different points, and the points leveled your character up for different bonuses and stuff like that, and then really got people trying to play the game. I think it was kind of an interesting promotion.
So the compendium itself, is it like an actual like a equipable in-game item, or like what does it do in game?
It's part of the UI,
Okay.
so it shows up not the in-game UI, but like the start screen UI, and you can go into it, and there's all sorts of stuff like in it. You could follow the tournament, you could pick your favorite teams, and stuff like that, and they all gave you points. But it also kind of encouraged you to play standard games, and I think they're ranked, kind of ranked system. It would give you points for that, and you just people just kind of wanted to level it up was the whole point. I mean, I didn't play that much because I'm more of a League of Legends guy, but I was interested in seeing what was going on with it.
And I know it must have been a big success because didn't the prize pool get, I think, over like 10 million or something?
Yeah, just over 10 million. It was
Damn.
let me see, what was it? 10,926,303, so almost 11 million.
And these types of game promotions are very interesting because they are pretty much a way of trying to convince you to either come back to a game or drum up more interest with it. And probably an older example would be all the stuff Valve has done with Team Fortress 2. They're, when they throw updates up, they have like these little stories with it, the comics, the movies, etc. I think their first big like community interaction was like the Saxie Awards, where they had people create in-game videos of Team Fortress 2 play, and then people will vote on them, and the winner, I think, would get like a unique in-game item. And it's kind of interesting in how these things are actually working. Now, with Payday 2, I know, allegedly a lot of people are just creating dummy Steam accounts and join the group, but we did see like generally some spikes when they either announced new stuff or when the game was on sale. So obviously, it is getting new, actual, like real living people interested in it. Now, with Dota 2, as you said, it convinced, like, they try to instill more value into the both the user who are buying it as well as to the tournament. And it sounds like it worked really well. What was the actual prize pool like at the start, or do you remember?
I don't remember. I know that it went up $2.50 for each purchase. So I want to say it was, God, I want to say it was like $1 million or something.
Damn, so that they definitely got the interaction involved with that. Now, does the compendium, excuse me, compendium do anything now that the tournament is over?
I don't know. I haven't actually looked.
Okay. Now, it still did it give you, I think you said this a few minutes ago, did it unlock like unique skins or unique items or anything like that?
You would get different bonuses, but like for instance, having it, and this is just surrounding it, not having to level it up, was you got stuff like a little Pudge courier, you got some new music, different environmental effects, new creeps, just interesting stuff.
Cool. Now with the Payday 2 one, it is basically on a timer. I know, as you said, with the compendium, that sort of ended like in terms of excitement after a tournament. For Payday 2's Crime Fest, basically everything is going to officially end on October 18th, where they're going to, one of the rewards already is that the first Payday is going to be free to basically get on that day. Which is pretty cool. Of course, I think everyone has already moved on to Payday 2. But we are seeing developers, I guess, go that extra mile in terms of promotions. I think the big thing would probably be the esports and just competitive play. I know, like, Hearthstone from Blizzard, there's tournaments with that now. And that game is fairly new, and they've already set up, multiple tournaments. I follow Trump. I think he's one of the expert players just trying to understand how the game plays by watching his feed. But we're definitely seeing more pushes towards attracting competitive and esports to the game industry. I think it's going to be really interesting just to see if that will fully, I guess, get into the casual or the general audience. Now with Dota 2, I remember there was some footage from like ESPN when they were complaining about, is Dota 2 really considered a sport? And I think they actually showed the Dota 2 tournament on ESPN 2. So that was pretty interesting. It's kind of weird, I think, that video games are being shown on TV.
No,
But
it's awesome, yeah.
I still think it's we still haven't seen the full impact of it. I know this year what was interesting was they finally announced that competitive esports players can file for, I think, passports, like the same passports that actual
Visas,
athletes
yeah.
get. Yeah, so I
That's
do
really good.
wonder if we're starting to see the takeover of the esports sort of becoming more mainstream now.
I don't know. I mean, it's certainly a big deal. A lot of viewers, a lot of money. It's hard to ignore, you know.
Yeah. All right. I think with that, we can start wrapping things up. I know it's getting late, and I think we had a pretty good cast as, like the emergency last day of the week type situation.
Oh yeah.
So I guess to wrap things up, Jason, do you have any final thoughts or topics you want to share?
No, I can't think anything.
All right. Yep. I guess for me, sales is one of those issues that we're going to talk more about as we probably have more guests on over the coming weeks, because it is such a very pivotal part of not just game development, but selling and marketing your game that it has really become the grand topic for developers, publishers, and storefronts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess with that, we're going to wrap things up. Jason, thanks again for coming on and being my emergency guest.
Oh, well, hey, I'm always happy to.
And yeah, and hopefully we won't have to wait 3, 4 months to have you back on. Maybe we can have you on for a regular cast at some point.
Yeah, we'll have to absolutely do that.
Awesome. And for those of you listening, thanks again for tuning into the Perceptive Podcast. And as always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, there are several ways to do so. For those of you interested in either writing a guest piece or being a future podcast guest, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And for those of you who would like to contribute to our monthly Patreon campaign to hopefully secure funding to improve the site, you can find all the information for that under the Patreon banner on the top of the front page. So, with that said, thank you for tuning in. Have a great rest of the weekend, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.